Eight three red shirts from off the line. Bill took a stick, gave him a whack, and tied him to the railroad. My voice cracks and fades into silence. She pedals her feet in the air and howls, and my ears are ringing, and I crawl onto the bed next to her, my pleas swallowed by her voice. I don't want to leave the room. I don't want to sleep. I am afraid that if I sleep, I will wake up, and Mara will be gone. And in the silence, entropy will take over, and my cells will expand, and I will become one with the air. If I turn away, even for a second, I will look back, and this will be just a mass of blankets and pillows, as empty a bed as it ever has been. If I blink, her form could dissolve beneath my fingers, and once again, I will be just me. Undeserving. Alone. When I wake up, she is still here. It feels like a sign. If she cried in the night, I did not hear it. I slept the kind of sleep where you wake up and know that you didn't flop around like a fucking hooked fish. You didn't keep me up all goddamned night with your sleep weeping. Jesus Christ. You know that you were good, and still. So my joints feel like the fat rubber bands used to bind broccoli. And my face is lined, where I'd stupidly slept sleep pressed against the seams of the quilt's patchwork. Mara is not crying. She's pumping her arms and legs around like pistons. Her eyes are opening and closing. Morning glories screwing up tightly in the midday sun. Venus flytraps yawning wide to vibrations and heat. I stand up and squint into the morning. Mara makes a squeaking noise. I pick her up. She seems heavier than yesterday. Is that possible? As soon as I step out of the bedroom, she begins to scream again. We take a bus to Indianapolis, transfer in a daze. She sleeps in my arms and does not stir except to scream, decibels swallowing all conscious thought. The bodies around me, rumpled and stale, do not react appreciatively to the silence or angrily to the sound, for which I am grateful. When we get off the bus in Bloomington, I remember, that it is spring. I find a ride with a kind woman, who reminds me of someone I have forgotten. We drive along the highway until I ask her to stop. "There's nothing here," she says. Her body language is almost purposefully relaxed. The leaves rustle, as if in answer. "Let me take you downtown," she says. "Or is there someone I can call for you?" I get out, Mara in the crook of my arm. It has rained recently. The mud is caking around my sneakers more and more with each step. I walk like a colossal monster, ready to level a city. There, up the slope of a hill, is a house. Our house. I recognize the stained glass, the smoke curling from the chimney and lacing up through the canopy of the trees. The picnic table outside needs a fresh coat of paint. An aging German shepherd, all bones and skin, is draped over the edge of a porch, his tail thumping in happiness as we approach. "Otto," I say, and he lets me squeeze the ruff of his neck. He taps his jowls against my palm, and then licks it clean. The door is unlocked, because Bad and I trust our neighbors, the birds. Inside, the floors are stone. I recognize the cabinets, the bed. Mara is silent in my arms. She does not even squirm. Perhaps she has been crying so much because she hasn't been home, but now she is home and now she is quiet. I sit down at a desk and roll a heavy pen across the wood. I run my fingers over the row of books alongside the wall. Behind the bookcase, a thin crack meanders through the plaster. Deliberate. I touch it with my fingertip, trace it up, up, up until it is past my height. Part of me wants to move the bookshelf, look behind it, but there is no need. I know what's there. I unwrap cured salmon from the fridge and examine it. The meat is drawn back from the forgotten pin bones like diseased gum from teeth. I make a mark deep in the flesh with my finger, and something inside of me is sated. I press my cheek against the wavy glass window pane. Otto has followed us inside and is trailing behind me, bumping his cold nose into Mara's foot. I pull a cookbook off the counter and flip it open. The cover thuds. "Aunt Julia's Bean Salad," I read. So much dill. The last night of us, bad, threw me into a wall. I wish I could remember why. It seems like context would matter. She was all bone and muscle and skin and light and laughter one minute, and then a tornado the next, a shadow passing over her face like a solar eclipse. My head cracked the plaster. Light sparked behind my eyes. "You cunt," she screamed. "I hate you. I fucking hate you. I have always hated you." I crawled to the bathroom and locked the door. From the outside, she rained punches into the wall like a hailstorm, and I turned on the shower and undressed and stepped inside. I'm a Cancer, a water baby, always. For a moment, I was there, the Indiana woods, the rain striking the leaves, the gentle Sunday morning drizzle during which we slept, only waking to see a sleepy preteen Mara come in, complain about a nightmare and curl into our arms. This will not always last. One day she will be too big for this, and for us, her old mothers. Then the not memory washed away like a wet painting in a storm. And I was in the shower, shaking, and she was outside, losing me. And there was no way for me to tell her not to. There was no way for me to tell her that we are so close. We are so close. Please don't do this now. We are so fucking close. "What do you think, Mara?" I ask her, spinning around a few times before coming to rest against a wall. I lay her down on the heirloom quilt that is snapped smartly over the big bed. One day I want to teach Mara to quilt like this, the way her grandmother did, and the way that I am learning. We could start small, baby quilts. You can do one of those in a night. Otto barks. The door opens, and around it curves a skinny arm, then a face, and a bright yellow backpack. A little girl of 10 or 11, hair in an unraveling braid. It is Mara, old enough to walk, old enough to speak, old enough to be bullied and then to face the bullies down, old enough to ask questions without answers and have problems without solutions. Behind her, another child, a boy, her baby brother, Tristan. I remember his birth like it happened last week, like it is happening now. He was all blood and sideways. He was up in my ribs and refused the midwife's advances. Even now my stomach is still not the same, the walls once severed and pulled apart. And he will grow. And then he grew. And Tristan followed after Mara. Follows her still. She said she hated it, but she loved it. I could tell she adored the attention. Mara and Tristan. Brown-haired children. Brown like someone's grandmother. Maybe mine. A man behind them and a woman, both staring at me. The woman tells Mara to stay away. The man clutches baby Tristan across his chest. They ask me who I am, and I answer them. Otto barks. The woman calls him, but he barks at her and at me, and does not cede his ground. Mara, Remember how you kicked sand into that neighbor child's eyes? I yelled at you and made you apologize in your best dress. And that night I cried by myself in the bathroom because you are Bad's child as much as you are mine. Remember when you ran into the plate glass window and cut your arm so badly we had to drive you to the nearest hospital in the pickup truck? And when it was over, Bad begged me to replace the back seat because of all the blood? Or when Tristan told us that he wanted to invite a boy to prom, and you put your arm around him like this? Mara, remember? Your own babies? Your husband with his Captain Ahab beard and calloused hands and the house you bought in Vermont? Mara, how you still love your little brother with the ferocity of a star, an all-consuming love that will only end when one of you collapses? The drawings you handed us as children, your paintings of dragons, Tristan's photographs of dolls, your stories about anger, his poems about angels, the science experiments in the yard, blackening the grass to gloss, your lives sated and solid, strange but safe. Do you remember? Why are you crying? Don't cry, don't. You cried a lot as a baby, but you've been so stoic ever since. Inside of me, a voice. There was nothing tying you to her, and you made it anyway. You made them anyway. Fuck you. You made them anyway. To Mara and her brother, I say, stop running, you'll fall. Stop running, you'll break something. Stop running. Your mother will see. She will see, and she will be so angry, and she will yell, and we cannot, I cannot. I say, don't leave the faucet on. You'll flood the house. Don't do it. You promised it would never happen again. Don't flood the house. The bills. Don't flood the house. The rugs. Don't flood the house, my loves. Or we could lose you both. We've been bad mothers and have not taught you how to swim. Especially heinous. 272 views of Law and Order SVU. Season 1. Payback. Stabler and Benson investigate the castration and murder of a New York City cab driver. They discover that the victim had assumed the identity of another man years before because he was wanted by police. In the end, Stabler discovers that the stolen identity of the man in question was also stolen, and he and Benson have to begin the investigation all over again. That night, as he tries unsuccessfully to sleep, Stabler hears a strange noise. A deep drumming. Two beats. It seems like it's coming from his basement. When he investigates the basement, it sounds like it's coming from outside. A single life. The old woman couldn't bear getting dressed alone anymore. The solitary donning of shoes broke her heart over and over again. The unlocked front door, through which any neighbor could wander, would have been an afterthought. But there was no thought. After. Or just look like one. Two underage models are attacked while walking home from a club. They are raped and murdered. To add insult to injury, they are confused with two other raped and murdered underage models who coincidentally are their respective twins, and both pairs are buried beneath the wrong tombstones. Hysteria. Benson and Stabler investigate the murder of a young woman who is initially believed to be a prostitute, and the latest in a long line of connected victims. I hate this goddamned city, Benson says to Stabler, dabbing her eyes with a deli napkin. Stabler rolls his eyes and starts the car. Wanderlust. The old DA irons her hair before court, the way her mother showed her. After she loses the case, she packs three changes of clothes in a suitcase and gets into her car. She calls Benson from her cell phone. Sorry, buddy, hitting the road, not sure when I'll be back. Benson pleads with her to stay. The old DA tosses the cell phone onto the road and pulls away from the curb. A passing taxi reduces it to splinters. Sophomore jinx. The second time the basketball team covers up a murder, the coach decides that he's finally had enough. Uncivilized. They find the boy in Central Park, looking like no one had ever loved him. His body was crawling with ants, Stabler says. Ants. 2 days later, they arrest his teacher, who, as it turns out, had loved him just fine. Stalked. Benson and Stabler aren't allowed to notch any of the precinct's furniture, so they each have their own private system. Benson's headboard has 8 scores that run along the curved oak edge like a spine. Stabler's kitchen chair has 9. Stocks and bondage. Benson takes the bag of rotten vegetables out of the trunk when Stabler isn't looking. She throws it into a garbage can, and it hits the empty bottom, wet and heavy. It splits open like a body that's been in the Hudson. Closure. It was inside of me, the woman says, pulling the bendy straw out of shape like a misused accordion. But now it is outside of me. I would like to keep it that way. Bad blood. Stabler and Benson will never forget the case where solving the crime was so much worse than the crime itself. Russian love poem. When they bring the mother up to the stand, the new DA asks her to state her name. She closes her eyes, shakes her head, rocks back and forth in her chair. She begins to sing a song, softly under her breath, not in English, the syllables rolling out of her mouth like smoke. The DA looks to the judge for help, but he is staring at the witness. His eyes as distant as if he were lost in the forest of his own memory. Disrobed. A disoriented, naked, pregnant woman is discovered wandering around Midtown. She is arrested for indecent exposure. Limitations. Stabler discovers that even New York City ends. Entitled. You can't do this to me, the man shouts as he is escorted to the witness stand. Don't you know who I am? The DA closes her eyes. Sir, I just need you to confirm that you did tell the police you saw a blue Honda fleeing the scene. The man pounds his open hand on the witness stand in defiance. I do not recognize your authority! The mother of the dead girl begins screaming so loudly that her husband carries her out of the courtroom. The third guy. Stabler never told Benson about his little brother, but he also never told her about his older brother, which was understandable because he didn't know about him either. Misleader. Father Jones has never touched a child, but when he closes his eyes at night, he still remembers his high school girlfriend, her soft thighs, her lined hands, the way she dropped off that roof like a falcon. Chat room. Convinced that his teenaged daughter is in danger from cyber predators, a father takes a crowbar to the family computer. He throws the pieces into the fireplace, strikes a match. His daughter complains of a light head, a burning in her chest. She calls him Mom, with tears in her voice. She dies on a Saturday. Contact. Stabler discovers that his wife believes she saw a UFO, back when she was in her early 20s. He lies awake all night, wondering if this explains the memory loss, the PTSD, the night terrors. His wife wakes up weeping and screaming. On cue. Remorse. At night, Stabler makes a list of the day's regrets. Didn't tell Benson, he scrawls. ate more burrito than I had room for. Misspent that gift card. Hit that guy harder than I meant to. His wife comes up behind him and rubs his shoulder idly before crawling into bed. Haven't told my wife today. We'll probably not tell her tomorrow. Nocturne. The ghost of one of the murdered, misburied underage models begins to haunt Benson. She has bells for eyes, tiny brass ones dangling from the top of each socket, the hammers not quite touching her cheekbones. The ghost does not know her own name. She stands over Benson's bed, the right bell tinkling faintly, and then the left, and then the right again. This happens four nights in a row at 2:07 a.m. Benson starts sleeping with a crucifix and pungent ropes of garlic, because she does not understand the difference between vampires and murdered teenagers. Not yet. Slaves. The precinct's interns are monsters. When it's slow, they dick around on the phones. Into the dial tones, they chirp, SVU, Manhattan's rapiest police department. They have theories about Stabler and Benson. They place bets. They place lilacs, Benson's favorite, in her locker, and daisies, Stabler's, in his. The interns drug Benson's and Stabler's coffees, and then after they fall asleep in the back room, the interns shove the cots close together and place both the detectives in compromising positions. Benson and Stabler wake up hours later, their hands on each other's cheeks, both wet with tears. Season 2. Wrong is Right. Benson wakes up in the middle of the night. She is not in her bed. She is in her pajamas in the dark. Her hand is on a handle. A door is open. A confused-looking panda is watching her with dewy eyes. Benson shuts the door. She passes two llamas chewing thoughtfully on the sign for a hot dog stand. In the parking lot of the zoo, her car is idling against a cement post. She changes into the spare set of clothes she keeps in the trunk. She calls it in. Eco-terrorists, she tells Stabler. He nods, jots down something in his notebook, then looks back up at her. Do you smell garlic? He asks. Honor. Stabler dreams that a man at a Renaissance fair insults Stabler's wife, and Stabler punches him in his self-satisfied face. When Stabler wakes up, he decides to tell his wife this story. He rolls over. She is gone. Stabler has never been to a Renaissance fair. Closure, Part 2. It's not that I hate men, the woman says. I'm just terrified of them, and I'm okay with that fear. Legacy. Over breakfast, Stabler's daughter asks him about Benson's family. Stabler says that Benson doesn't have a family. You always say that family is a man's one true wealth, says Stabler's daughter. Stabler thinks about this. It's true, he says. But Benson is not a man. Baby killer. Benson keeps the condoms in her nightstand drawer refreshed and throws the expired ones away. She dutifully takes her pill at the same time every morning. She makes dates and always keeps them. Non-compliance. The girl with bells for eyes tells Benson to go to Brooklyn. They can communicate now with the bells. Benson taught herself Morse code. Benson never goes to Brooklyn, but she agrees. She rides the train late at night, so late that there is only one man in her car, and he is sleeping on a duffel bag. As they shoot through the tunnels, the man looks blearily at Benson, then unzips his duffel bag and vomits into it, almost politely. The vomit is white, like cream of wheat. He re-zips the bag. Benson gets off two stops too early and ends up walking through Prospect Park for a very long time. asunder. Stabler works out every morning at the precinct. He does tricep curls. He does crunches. He jogs on a treadmill. He thinks he hears his daughter's voice crying his name. Startled, he trips on the treadmill and his whole body slams against the cinder block wall. The path rolls toward him in endless loops. Taken. It was dark, says Stabler's wife. I was walking home alone. It was raining. Well, not really raining, spitting, I guess. Misting. It was misting, and the light from the street lamps was all pooled and golden and thick as oil. And I was breathing deeply, and it felt healthy, healthy and right to be walking through that night. Stabler hears the drumming again. It shakes the water glass on the nightstand. Stabler's wife doesn't seem to notice. Pixies. Get out! Benson screams, hurling pillows at the girl with bells for eyes. She's brought a friend this time, a small girl with hair in tight cornrows and her lips stitched shut. Benson gets out of bed and tries to push them away, but her hands and upper body go through both of them as if they were nothing. They taste like mildew in her mouth. She remembers being 8 and kneeling before the humidifier in her room, taking in the steam as if it were the only way she could drink. Consent. Stabler, says Benson carefully. Stabler looks up from his raw knees. Benson unfolds the tiny square alcohol wipe and hands it to him. Can I sit here? Can I help? He nods wordlessly, lets her rub his knees. He hisses with pain through his teeth. What did you do? She asks. The treadmill? Are these from the treadmill? Stabler shakes his head. He can't say. He can't. Abuse. More regrets. The lines crowd the page. Showed Benson my skinned knees, allowed her to assist me. Told my wife nothing was wrong. Let my wife tell me that nothing was wrong and didn't tell her that I could tell she was lying. Secrets. The girls with bells for eyes tell Benson to go to Yonkers. Benson refuses and begins to burn sage in her apartment. Victims. Her apartment is so crowded with ghosts that, for the first time since she can remember, Benson stays at someone else's place for the night. Her date is an investment banker, a boring and stupid man with a fat, piss-mean tabby who tries to suffocate Benson with her bulk. When she returns to her apartment the next morning, sore and angry and smelling like cat pee, the girls with bells for eyes are waiting for her, draped over every surface like Dolly's clocks. They crowd around her as she slowly brushes her teeth. She spits, rinses, and turns. All right, she says. What do you want me to do? Paranoia. I'm not suppressing anything, Stabler's wife yells at him. Tell me about the night with the aliens, says Stabler. He is trying to learn. He is trying to figure it out. It was misty, she says. It was spitting. He hears the banging again, the tone sounding from somewhere in the house. It makes his head ache. Yes, I know, Stabler says. The light pooled around the lampposts like oil. There were so many iron gates, I walked past them and ran my fingers over their loops and whorls, and then my finger smelled like metal. Yes, says Stabler. But then what? But his wife is asleep. Countdown. The madman promises that there is a bomb hidden under a bench in Central Park. Do you know how many benches there are in Central Park? Shouts Stabler, clutching an intern by his shirt collar. They send police officers to Central Park to chase people off benches as if they are pigeons or the homeless. Nothing happens. Runaway. The girl with bells for eyes sends Benson into every borough. Benson rides the subway. Eventually, she has seen every stop at least once. She is beginning to memorize the murals, the water stains, the smells. The Columbus Circle Station smells like a urinal. Cortelyou smells unnervingly like lilacs. For the first time in a while, Benson thinks about Stabler. Back in her apartment, a girl with bells for eyes tries to tell Benson a story. I was a virgin. When he took me, I popped. Folly.
There is a case, says the captain. A young boy has accused his mother of beating him into unconsciousness with a toilet plunger. This is a tricky one, though. The boy is the son of a political heavyweight with deep pockets. He golfs with the mayor. His wife is... Benson? Benson, are you listening?
Manhunt. Stabler has determined that he is not even a little bit gay. He swallows his disappointment. His mouth tastes like orange peel. Parasites. Oh, fuck, says Stabler's wife. Fuck. Sweetie, the kids have lice. I need your help. They stand the kids in the tub. The oldest daughter rolls her eyes. Her mother helps them scrub their scalps, and the younger three whine that the shampoo burns. Stabler feels serene for the first time in months. Peak.
The victim has ties to the modeling industry, says the captain. But we're having trouble tracking down where she lived. She might have come from another country. She was only 14.
He hangs her autopsy photo on the bulletin board, her face flat and pale. The thumbtack pops into the cork, and Benson jumps in her chair. Scourge. Stabler hears it again, the sound, the drumming. It seems to come from the break room. When he goes there, it sounds like it is coming from the interrogation room. Inside the interrogation room, he hears it again. He bangs his hands on the two-way mirror, imitating the sound, hoping to lure it to him. But all is quiet. Season 3. Repression. In the middle of a sermon, Father Jones begins screaming. His parishioners look on in fear as he clings to the pulpit, wailing a name over and over. Convinced that this is an admission of guilt of some kind or another, the diocese calls Benson and Stabler. In his office, Benson knocks a pen off his desk, and Father Jones dives after it, howling. Wrath. Benson reaches up from her bed like a baby. A girl with bells for eyes stands over her like a mother. Benson grabs at the bells, pulls them as hard as she can. The girl with bells for eyes jerks violently, and every light bulb in Benson's apartment explodes, covering the carpet with glass. Stolen. First it's a candy bar. The next day, a lighter. Stabler wants to stop, but he learned long ago to choose his battles. Rooftop. Just tell me what you remember, Father. Click.
Okay, her name was... Well, I don't want to say it. She hated water and grass, so we picnicked on the top of her apartment building. She lived in that building with her mother. I loved her. I lost myself in her body. We lay a blanket over the gravel. I fed her orange slices. She told me she was a prophet, and that she had a vision that one day I would take an innocent life. I said no, no. She climbed up onto the cement wall that circled the roof. She stood there and declared her vision again. She said she was sorry. She didn't even fall like I expected. She simply knelt into the air. Tangled. Stabler finds Benson sleeping on a sagging cot in the back room at the precinct. She wakes up when the door opens. She looks like she has run the gauntlet, which is something Stabler's mother used to say before she left. Come to think of it,
It's the last phrase Stabler can remember her speaking before that door swung shut. Redemption. Benson accidentally catches a rapist when she Google stalks her newest OKCupid date. She can't decide whether or not to mark this in the success, caught rapist, or failure, date didn't work out, column. She marks it in both. Sacrifice. Benson leaves her handsome date at the table in the restaurant waiting for the drinks. She turns down an empty side street. She takes off her shoes and walks down the center of the road. It is too hot for April. She can feel her feet darkening from the blacktop. She should be afraid of broken glass, but she is not. In front of a vacant lot, she stops. She reaches down and touches the pavement. It is breathing. Its two-toned heartbeat makes her clavicle vibrate. She can feel it. She is suddenly irrevocably certain that the earth is breathing. She knows that New York is riding the back of a giant monster. She knows this more clearly than she has ever known anything before. Inheritance. The phrase, run the gauntlet, is stuck in Stabler's head, like water dripping and sluicing around his inner ear. He presses the muscles at the hinge of his jaw and cracks it. The crack takes the place of the single syllable of run. He does it again. Crack. The gauntlet. Run. The cracklet. Run. Care. Stabler is worried about Benson, but he cannot tell her. Ridicule. Benson does her twice-monthly grocery trip. She drives her car to a grocery store in Queens and buys $300 worth of produce. It will make her fridge look like the Garden of Eden. She will not eat it, while she gnaws on chewy French toast in the styrofoam container from the diner. The produce will, predictably, rot. Her fridge will smell overwhelmingly like dirt. She will collect it in garbage bags and throw it in the public trash can near the station before her next trip. Monogamy. Stabler wakes up one night to find his wife staring at the ceiling, tears soaking the pillow next to her head. It was spitting, she says. My fingers smelled like metal. I was so scared. For the first time, Stabler understands. Protection. Benson crosses the street without looking. The taxi driver slams on his brakes, his bumper stopping a hair's width from Benson's shins. When she looks through the windshield, she sees a teenage boy in the passenger seat, eyes closed. When he opens them, the sun glints off the curves of the bells. The taxi driver screams at Benson as she stares. Prodigy.
Look at me, Dad!
Stabler's daughter says, laughing, twirling. As clearly as if he were watching a movie, he sees her in 2 years' time, swatting a boyfriend's hands away in a back seat, harder and harder. She screams. Stabler starts. She has fallen to the ground and is clutching her ankle, crying. Counterfeit. You don't understand, says Father Jones to Benson. There are dark curves under his eyes, sacks the colors of bruised apples. He is wearing a terry cloth bathrobe that says, Susan, in machine-stitched cursive letters on the breast pocket.
I can't help you. I'm having a crisis of faith.
He tries to close the door, but Benson stops it with her hand. I'm having a crisis of function, she says. Tell me, what do you know about ghosts? Execution. The medical examiner pulls back the sheet from the dead girl's face. Raped and strangled, she says, her voice hollow. Your murderer pressed his thumbs into the girl's windpipe until she died. No prints, though. Stabler thinks that the girl looks a little like his wife's high school photo. Benson is certain she can see the jelly of the girl's eyes receding beneath their closed lids. Certain she can hear the sound of bells. In the car,
They are both quiet.
Popular. They question everyone they can think of. Her friends and enemies, the girls she bullied, the boys who loved her and hated her, the parents who thought she was wonderful, and the parents who thought she was bad news. Benson stumbles into the precinct late, bleary-eyed. My theory, she says, drinking her coffee slowly with shaking hands. My theory is that it was her coach, and my theory is that the missing underwear will be found in his office. The search warrant is issued so quickly that they find the underwear in his top desk drawer, still damp with blood.
Surveillance.
Benson doesn't know how to explain to Stabler the heartbeat beneath the ground. She is certain that she can hear it all the time now, deep and low. The girls with bells for eyes have taken to knocking before coming in, sometimes. Benson takes taxis to faraway neighborhoods, gets down on her hands and knees on the street and the sidewalk, and once in a woman's vegetable garden that took up her entire postage stamp lawn. She can hear it everywhere, the drumming echoing, echoing in the deep. Guilt. Benson can translate the bells so well now. There is no delay between their chiming and her understanding. She pulls her pillow over her head until she can barely breathe.
Give us voices. Give us voices. Give us voices. Tell him. Tell him. Tell him. Find us. Find us. Find us. Please. Please. Please.
Justice. Benson gets a pack of small children. Their bells are especially tiny, the ring higher than most. Benson is drunk. She holds her bed, which feels like an amusement park ride, pitching and rolling.
We will never ride the tilt-a-whirl again, ever. Get up! Get up!
They command her. She puts her head on her cell phone and uses speed dial.
My theory, she says to Stabler. My theory is that I have a theory.
Stabler offers to come over.
My theory, she says. My theory is that there is no God.
The children's bells ring so furiously that Benson can't even hear Stabler's reply over the din. When Stabler comes over and lets himself in with the spare key, he finds Benson bent over the toilet, heaving, crying.
Freed. It's the whole city, Benson says to herself as she drives.
She imagines Stabler in the seat next to her. I've been all over. It's the whole fucking city. The heartbeats. The girls. She clears her throat and tries again. I know it sounds crazy. I just have a feeling. She pauses, then says,
Stabler, do you believe in ghosts?
Then, Stabler, do you trust me?
Denial.
Stabler finds the police report for his wife's rape. It's so old that he has to call in a favor from a guy in the records department. The sound of the paper scraping against the thin manila envelope slows Stabler's heart.
Competence.
Stabler and Benson respond to a report of a rape in Central Park. When they get there, the mutilated body has already been taken to the medical examiner's office. A confused junior cop is busy rolling yellow crime scene tape from tree to tree.
Weren't you just here?
He asks them.
Silence.
Benson and Stabler grab beers at a pub down the street from the station. They hold the frosted mugs tightly in their hands, leave glossy, sweating prints that look like angels. They say nothing.
Chameleon.
Abler and Henson respond to a report of a rape in Central Park. They examine the mutilated body.
Cult, says Abler.
Occultists, says Henson.
A cult of occultists, they say in unison. Take the body away.
Deception.
Henson sleeps through every night. She wakes up refreshed. She eats a sesame seed bagel with chive cream cheese for breakfast and with it a mug of green tea. Abler tucks in his kids and spoons his wife, who laughs in her sleep. When they get up, she relates to him the very funny joke from her dream, and he laughs too. The children make pancakes. The hardwood floors are flooded with pools of light. Vulnerable. For 3 days in a row, there is not a single victim in the entire precinct. No rapes, no murders, no rape murders, no kidnappings. No child pornography made, bought, or sold. No molestations. No sexual assaults. No sexual harassments. No forced prostitution. No human trafficking. No subway gropings. No incest. No indecent exposures. No stalking. Not even an unwanted dirty phone call. Then, in the gloaming of a Wednesday, a man wolf whistles at a woman on her way to an AA meeting. The whole city releases its long-held breath, and everything returns to normal. Lust. Abler and Henson are sleeping together, but no one knows. Henson is the best lay that Abler's ever had. Henson's had better. Disappearing acts. What are you doing here again? The victim's grandmother asks them. Benson looks at Stabler and Stabler at Benson, and they turn, confused, back to her. I already told you everything I know, the old woman says, waving a gnarled hand at them dismissively. She slams the door so hard a flower pot jumps off the porch railing and lands on the lawn. Did you come and see her? Benson asks Stabler. He shakes his head. You? He asks her. Inside, a Mills Brothers record starts up with pops and scratches. Shine, little glowworm, glimmer, glimmer. No, Benson says. Never. Angels. Abler's sons bring home perfect grades and don't even need braces. Henson's many lovers bring her to increasingly ascending levels of ecstatic transcendence, vis-a-vis the clitoris, vis-a-vis asking her what she wants, yes, what she, yes, what, yes, 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 fuck, yes. Dolls. The bells ring, ring, ring through the night, the peels stripping skin from Benson's body. Well, that's how it feels, anyway. Faster, faster, go faster. I need to sleep, Benson says. I need to sleep to go faster. That makes no sense. We never get to sleep. We never sleep. We tirelessly pursue injustice at all hours. Don't you remember needing sleep? Benson asks wearily from her unwashed sheets. You were human once. No, 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 no! Waste. There are so many notches in Benson's headboard, so many successes, so many failures, maybe she should have kept them apart, that the wood looks like it's been chewed away by termites. When the two-tone beat sounds, the chips and shavings tremble on her carpet and nightstand. Juvenile. 5-year-olds murder 6-year-olds, Benson says dully. The skin beneath her eyes dusky ash from lack of sleep. People can be monsters, or vulnerable as lambs. They, no, we, are perpetrators and victims at the same time. It takes so little to tip the scale one way or the other. This is the world we live in, Stabler. She sips noisily on her Diet Coke. She tries to look away from Stabler's wet eyes. Resilience. Benson watches a lot of TV on her days off. She gets an idea. She spreads a line of salt along her threshold on the window sills. That night, for the first time in months,
The girls with bells for eyes, stay away.
Damaged.
Stabler rubs his wife's shoulders.
Can we talk?
She shakes her head.
You don't want to talk.
She nods.
You want to talk.
She shakes her head.
You don't want to talk.
She nods. Stabler kisses her hair.
Later. We'll talk later.
Risk. Abler and Henson solve their 9th case in a row, and their captain takes them out for celebratory steaks and cocktails. Abler gnaws on hunks of steak too big for his gullet. Henson polishes off one dirty martini after another. 10 of them. 11. A man on the opposite side of the restaurant, who has been nibbling bird-like on a Caesar salad, begins to choke. He turns blue. A stranger delivers the Heimlich, and a half-chewed wad of meat lands on the table of a lifelong teetotaler who is starting to feel a little strange.
I feel like I've had 12 drinks, she says, giggling, hiccuping.
She has. Henson drives Abler home, and they laugh. 13 blocks from the restaurant, they grope at each other, kissing as they stumble out of the car. Henson puts Abler's hand on her breast, and her nipple tightens.
Rotten.
Someone keeps leaving sacks of perfectly ripe produce in a trash can. Henson frequently finds herself pulling it out, taking it home, scrubbing the beets hard. How crazy. How weird to let a good thing go to waste.
Mercy.
The gunman lets all of the hostages go, including himself.
Pandora.
Benson is lonely without the bells. Her apartment is so quiet. She stands in her doorway, staring down at the white line. She takes her big toe and probes it. She remembers being at the beach with her mother when she was a child and burning her feet on the hot, smooth sand. She pushes her toe, breaking the line, and says, "Oops," but doesn't really mean it. The children come rushing at her like a flash flood rolling through a narrow gorge. Their bells ring chaotic, gleeful and rapturous and angry, like a swarm of euphoric bees. They tickle her skin with their desperation. She has never felt so loved.
Tortured.
You are the only one we trust,
the girls with bells for eyes say to Benson.
Not that other one.
Benson assumes they mean Stabler.
Privilege.
Abler and Henson notice the bullet casings buried in the dirt. They notice the smear of blood near the doorframe, the orientation of the street. They look at each other and know that they're each calculating the sunlight on this avenue at the time of the crime. By the time they get inside, they know to arrest the wife. They don't even have to ask her any questions.
Desperate.
If you are dead, you can see everything, Benson says to the girls with bells for eyes.
Tell me who the others are, the doppelgangers. Why are they so much better at everything than me and Stabler? Tell me, please.
The bells ring and ring and ring.
Appearances.
Benson sees Henson coming out of the precinct. Her stomach gnarls. The same face, but prettier. The same hair, but bouncier.
She must find out what kind of products she uses before she kills her.
Dominance.
You're a lunatic,
Henson says, struggling against the handcuffs and ropes and chair and chains. Benson leaves Stabler another message.
My partner is going to come and get me, you'll see,
Henson says.
He'll come for me.
Fallacy.
Stabler will come and back me up. He knows what you've been doing, stealing our cases, pretending to be us.
Futility. Stabler pulls out his cell phone as the ringtone dies.
14 new voicemails.
He can't do it. He can't.
The phone buzzes in his hand like an insect.
15.
He turns it off.
Grief.
Abler comes for Henson.
Of course he does.
He loves her. Benson watches as he gently unties the ropes, unwraps the chains, unlocks the handcuffs, and lets her stand up from the chair on her own. Benson is holding her gun in her hand. She unloads 3 bullets into each of them, not expecting much.
They keep moving,
as if nothing were happening. They foxtrot down the street and out of sight.
Perfect.
Detective, how can you not account for bullets missing from your gun? What are you listening to, Benson?
No, I can't hear it.
There's no sound. What are you talking about?
Soulless.
Father Jones? Benson says, her forehead pressing into the rough carpet in his foyer.
Something is really wrong with me.
He puts his tumbler down, sits next to her.
Yeah, he says. I know the feeling.
Season 5. Tragedy. Miles away from the precinct, a teenage boy and his 7-year-old sister drop dead in the middle of their walk home from school. When they are autopsied, bullets are pulled from the purple meat of their organs, though there are no entrance wounds on either of their bodies. The medical examiner is baffled. The bullets clink, 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 clink in the metal dish.
Manic.
The DA laughs and laughs. She laughs so hard she coughs. She laughs so hard she pees a little. She falls down onto the floor and does a little quarter roll, still laughing. There is a knock on the bathroom door, and Benson pushes open the door, uncertainly.
Are you all right?
The jury has come back. Are you okay?
Mother.
Your mother called today, Stabler's wife says to him. Please call her back so I don't have to make an excuse for you.
Stabler looks up from his desk, where the manila envelope is resting so anemically thin he wants to scream.
He looks over at the mother of his children, the hollow at the base of her throat, the fine fringe of her eyelashes, the fat zit on her chin that she is probably minutes from popping.
I need to talk to you,
he says.
Loss.
You have to understand, says Father Jones. I loved her. I loved her more than I have loved everything. But she was sad, so sad. She couldn't bear to be here anymore. She saw too much.
Serendipity. Father Jones shows Benson how to pray. She clasps her hands together like a child, because that is the last time she tried it. He talks about opening her mind. She pulls her knees up to her chest. If I open my mind any further, they'll crowd out everything. When he asks her what she means, she just shakes her head.
Coerced.
I made it up, the woman says dully. Benson looks up from her yellow legal pad.
Are you certain?
She asks.
Yes, the woman says. Start to finish.
I certainly, definitely made it up from start to finish.
Choice.
Outside of the courtroom, protesters shove and shout, the wooden dowels of their signs knocking noisily against one another. It sounds like percussion. The worst percussion. Benson and Stabler use their bodies to shield the woman, who sobs and shuffles. Benson looks left, looks right.
Shots.
The woman crumples. Her blood runs down a storm drain and she dies with her eyes half open, an interrupted eclipse. Benson and Stabler feel the beat at the same time, down beneath the pavement, beneath the screaming and the panicked crowd and the signs and the woman dead, dead. There it is.